Water Management Division. He develops programs on public communication strategies to help landowners improve water quality and aquatic habitat. Before coming to Snohomish County, he had a great background set of experiences. He received degrees in civil environmental engineering and in architecture from the University of Illinois. And then he came out to Seattle and worked as an architect for 13 years. And then he directed two nonprofits. He was the director of the Audubon Society and also of the Stilly Snohomish Fisheries Enhancement Task Force, and he still currently is president of that. He also serves on the advisory board of the Water Center, and I have to tell you, we're very grateful to him because he's been a strong supporter of the Water Center events, both in terms of his time and volunteer efforts and in terms of financial contributions. And so if you went to the annual review, that was really thanks to the support of Dave Warren in Snohomish County. I also mentioned that Snohomish County has opportunities for interns and volunteers, so if you're interested in an internship during the summer, which also sometimes runs through the academic year, and these are paid internships, and there's also volunteer positions, of course, you can contact Dave. And so Collins is a self-described generalist. He has an unusual fondness for bugs, and I was just talking with him about his interest in moths, and that's also very fascinating. So let's offer a warm, grateful welcome to Dave Ward.
Thank you. So, as Ann said, I'm, you know, got my fingers in a lot of different pots. It's more like I call myself a generalist, but it's more like I have a short attention span. So, bear with me as I go through some of these ramblings. I work at Surface Water Management. We're a division of the Snohomish County Public Works Department, and we're the folks up in Snohomish County that are dealing with water quality, aquatic habitat, drainage, and flood hazard management. The only things that we don't deal with that pertain to water are water supply and wastewater treatment. So today what I'm here to talk with you about is the diffusion of landscape level best management practices. And as one of my coworkers said when he looked at the title of this program, what the heck does that mean? Well, diffusion is basically the process by which ideas or innovations spread across a population. And it doesn't matter whether it's an idea, it could be a political idea, it could be some other notion, or it could be some other technological advancement. You know, like this pen here. This is an example of diffusion. I bet everybody in this room has a pen or a pencil or something like that. Every one of you has that. There was a point in time when this didn't exist, and there was a process by which this spread across a population. So that's an example of diffusion. When we talk about best management practices, we're talking about all of the things that we want people to do on behalf of either water quality or aquatic habitat or flood hazard management. Those are all the things that people are doing in their backyards and in their businesses and in their homes to help water quality and aquatic habitat. We're talking about landscape level because it's not important to us whether one or two people do these things. It's important to us whether tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of people are doing these things. We have about, within the urban areas of Snohomish County, we have about 185,000 households. Every single one of those households, we need to be training them to be doing certain best management practices. So this is one example of one of those best management practices. This guy's in his backyard and he's scooping up his dog poop. The reason he's scooping up his dog poop is we like the fact that he's doing it because it's good for water quality. The reasons that he's doing it may have nothing to do with water quality. In fact, it probably has something to do with his nice green lawn, or it might have something to do with clean shoes. Keep that thought in mind because I'm going to touch on that theme in a little bit later. When it comes to things like aquatic habitat, we look at all the nasty things that people do to streams, and we have this long laundry list of stuff that we would love for streamside property owners to do. But I know very well that if somebody knocked on my door and handed that list of stuff to me and said, "Here, I want you to do all these things because you have a stream in your backyard," I'd slam the door in their face. And in fact, when we go to somebody and we hand them a laundry list of stuff to do, that's pretty much the reaction that we get. We get blocked out. So how do we deal with this? How do we get people to do some of these things for aquatic habitat and water quality? Well, we've got this handy-dandy tool called social marketing. And I don't know if you were around in one of the previous sessions, there was a speaker named Nancy Lee who came talked about social marketing. She talks about it at a policy level, and she talks about what the steps are in the process. I've got some examples here of how this is actually applied on the ground. So the first important thing to keep in mind is that education helps people to know things, but social marketing helps people to do things. This is a real important distinction. Now, I come from an engineering background, and I can't tell you how many times I've walked a stream with a bunch of engineers and scientists, and we've looked at what people have done to streams and backyards just like this and said, boy, if they only knew. If they only knew. We have to train them. We have to educate people so they won't do things like this. Well, I've got news for you. Education won't change this situation. Just because people know things doesn't mean that they're going to change their behavior. I mean, people do all kinds of things that are bad, even though they know they're bad. People use heroin. Everybody knows heroin's not very good for you. How many people know that multitasking while you're driving on the highway is a bad thing? But how many of you were on the cell phone while you were driving this morning? How many people text while they drive? Everybody knows it's bad, but people still do it. So why would we think that a streamside landowner would behave any differently? So we're going to spend some time talking about streamside landowners and some of the strange things that they do. This is one of my coworkers demonstrating. But first, we're going to have a little bit of fun with pet waste, because we spend a lot of time talking about pet waste. Now, the reason we care about pet waste is because it's a major contributor to bacterial contamination in our streams and in our rivers. So Snohomish County receives anywhere from 1 to 3 million gallons of rain per year per acre, depending on where you are in the landscape. And all of that rainwater washes off all the roofs and pavement and washes off all the yards, and all that dirty wash water all goes down the drains and it goes down all these things that we water quality people like to build. And eventually, all of that dirty wash water spits out of a culvert someplace and dumps into a stream or into a river. Now, what this little guy here doesn't know is that his favorite stream is actually flowing with the dirty wash water from about 1,000 yards upstream. And 40% of those yards has one of these in it. Now, this is a little device, just in case you don't recognize it. This is a device that specializes in two things. It puts things in one end, and you know it's coming. It lets things out the other. Now, what's in that material is the subject of mystery to some, but we all know that there is some pretty nasty stuff in here. And I'm not going to dwell on exactly everything that's in there, because we don't have a lot of time today, but suffice it to say that some of this stuff is pretty nasty, and you really want to steer clear of it if you can. So every time I talk about this, there's always somebody, usually in the back of the room, who goes, oh, come on, don't bears do it in the woods? So I want to address that right away. Yes, bears do it in the woods, and so do coyotes, and so do deer, and even people do it where they're not supposed to do it sometimes. But these guys, exist in higher concentrations than just about any other large mammal species, and they produce waste in greater volume than any other mammal in our urban areas other than people. So how do we start to address this problem? Well, the first thing we did was we went to consumer data, and we started to map where are the dog concentrations in Snohomish County. So this is a map of dog density. This is dogs per acre. It's probably the only time you'll ever see a map of dogs per acre. So the darker colors here are higher densities, and the lighter colors are lower densities of dogs. And we actually found concentrations up to 40 dogs per acre in some pockets. Incredibly high numbers. And so this is all based on consumer data. This is every time somebody runs their credit card through when they buy a bag of kibble or they buy a dog chew toy, it records, you know, where this person is living. So keep in mind, all you folks who are worried about things like black helicopters hovering over your houses, that every time you use your credit card, somebody's counting it. Anyway, so we look at where the dog concentrations are in the county, and strangely enough, it correlates directly to where the water quality problems are. And these are the areas where we have 303 delisted streams. These are the areas that are in violation of fecal contamination in the streams. So it's not that surprising that where we have dogs, we have problems. We find a direct correlation between human population, dog population, and impervious surfaces. So those three tend to go together really, really well. So in an effort to try to figure out what do we do about this huge problem, we started what we refer to as a formative research program. So this is basically we're doing our homework before we start talking to people about it. Because we know that if we just tell people that dog poop is bad for streams, that's not a real big motivator for people. So we want to figure out really how do we get this message across in a way that's going to produce results. So we looked at programs around the world. We did public opinion surveys. We did focus groups. We looked at demographics. We looked at all kinds of data on what is dog poop, where is it. This is the who, what, where, when, why, and how much of the study. And we found out how many households have dogs. We found out how many dogs there are in every dog-owning household. Now, this is the math part of the program, so get your calculators out. And we figured out how many dogs there are in Snohomish County, roughly. Now, this is based on statistics, but we ended up with a figure that's 126,000. Now, for what it's worth, this is based on 2000 and 2002 data. We just ran the numbers for 2008, and that number is actually about 20% higher right now. So the first thing that everybody asked us was, well, why didn't you just go with the number of licensed dogs? So we went to our auditor's office and we said, how many licensed dogs do we have? And the number's actually about 10% of that. So if we just talk to the licensed dog owners, we're getting a very small percentage of the overall dog population in the county. So we also did the same thing for cats, because cats are producing waste too, and there are actually more cats out there than there are dogs. But the difference is that dogs are bigger animals. So on the whole, the dogs are producing 2.7 times as much waste as cats. The other thing is that cats are burying it in the backyards. It's harder to find, harder to get people to pick it up because people aren't going to want to dig up their rose beds in order to get to the cat poop. And a lot of people also have their cats indoors too, so they're doing it in the litter pans, and it's already getting into the trash. So we put the cats aside for the moment, and we focused on dogs. We also realized that the solid waste output from dogs is roughly equivalent to a population of about 32,000 people. Now put this into perspective. All the dogs in Snohomish County are producing sewage at about the same volume as the city of Linwood. And it's landing in backyards. So when we looked at what do we do about this problem, we looked at all these dog waste programs around the world, and we found that most of them are based on primary sanitation. Most of them deal with waste in public areas. They're more concerned with clean shoes than they are with water quality. And that was true for our own program at the time as well. But when we looked at our research data, we found that most of the dog waste, in fact, it was about 87-89%, was actually landing in backyards, not in public areas. So we said, well, from a water quality perspective, this doesn't make any sense. Our programs are completely missing the mark. We're only addressing 15% of the waste. So we changed our focus dramatically. We decided to focus on people picking up their pet waste in their backyards. So once we focused on this, we got our focus groups of dog owners together, and we did telephone surveys with dog owners, and we did a whole bunch of audience research, and we found that dog owners generally fall into three different categories. There are those who are picking up their dog poop regularly and they're throwing it in the trash, just like we would like them to do. There are others that are picking up their waste regularly, but they're not disposing of it the way we want them to. They're not putting it in the trash. They might be burying it. They might be throwing it over the fence into their stream buffer. They might be doing other stuff with it. And then there are other people who are doing completely contrary behavior. They're not even picking up their pet waste. And we found when we got focus groups together, it's pretty amazing how freely people will say, oh yeah, I have 10 dogs and I've never picked up in my yard. So it's pretty amazing how open people get once they get into a comfortable environment. part of the research also is figuring out what kind of language do we use when we talk to people about this. This is, as silly a list as this looks, this is the list that we put in front of people in focus groups and in surveys to see what kind of language are people comfortable with when we talk about this subject matter. Because some people are really put off by the word poop. Other people might be put off by the word waste. So we have to narrow it down. And for what it's worth, poop was the least offensive word that we found. But we're also able to find out what are the key motivators for people. What are the things that would really motivate people to pick up their dog waste in their backyards? And notice that water quality is not on them, is not on this list at all. Water quality is not a motivator for people to pick up their yards. They are far more interested in safe kids and safe pets and clean shoes than they are about water quality. Now, this is a real important thing to remember here, because every single survey that you will see that says, is water quality important to you? You know, as a citizen, is water quality important? Everybody will always say, yes, water quality is very important. You know, and then you'll see it reported in the news the next morning that, you know, 89% of people said water quality is an important concern to them. Well, that's true. It is an important concern, but it's not a motivator to change behavior. Protecting their kids is a motivator to change behavior. Keeping their shoes clean is a motivator to change behavior. So we start playing on this stuff. I mean, we're out here trying to tell people that pet waste is raw sewage, and we need to start treating it as such. So then, and this is what we want them to do. We want people to scoop the poop, bag it, and place it in the trash. Now, this doesn't sound like rocket science. It's like, well, duh. But not everybody does this. Not everybody does this. 40% of the population is burying it in their backyards. They're not placing it in the trash. So once we develop these messages and we find out what words work, what words don't work, what phrases catch people, what are the motivators and what are the demotivators, then we can start crafting what is our program going to look like, what does the outreach material look like, what kinds of things are going to grab people's attention. I guarantee this grabs people's attention when this is a poster and you've got a turd on it that's 4 feet tall and you put this up at a fair, it attracts attention. And people get up and they get close to it, you know, and keep in mind that for every one of these images that you see, we had about 5 or 10 that didn't make the cut. Like, we ended up cutting the scratch and sniff one that we put together. But I guarantee that this will attract attention, and it will draw people in. They see scoop the poop bag and place it in the trash, and they go, oh, I didn't know I was allowed to place it in the trash. I thought I wasn't supposed to put it there. And then they go and they do it. And the nice thing about this is it's a real simple message. It's so simple that here what is essentially an information campaign really can have a dramatic on-the-ground effect. This image is by far our most popular image. We've gotten more mileage out of this one image than all the others put together. Why is it? Because it's very visceral. It's got the dog, and it's got a cute little kid. The two top motivators for behavior change. So then we start taking these images and these messages, and we start crafting it into other communication devices. It's not just a poster campaign, although we do have posters for the veterinarian clinics and stuff like that. But we also mail stuff to people's homes. And so part of what we did in our pilot program was we selected a neighborhood. This neighborhood was in the Mill Creek area, and they were basically our guinea pig neighborhood. We said, we're going to try and we're going to bombard them with information to see if it has an effect. So we put together these mail pieces. It says, yes, it's okay. Put it in the trash, because as I said before, people thought that they couldn't do it. So we're telling people, even if they don't open it up, even if they toss it, they still see that it's okay, and they know that it's okay to put their dog poop in the trash. The other thing that we need to know is, are people actually reading the mail? You know, we can send out all kinds of information, and we can hand out flyers, and we can do everything. We can do all kinds of stuff, but unless we know people are reading it, it's not doing any good. So we put a reply card on the bottom of the mailer. Okay, so what's the motivator to return the reply card? So we scratched our head and we said, well, we have to give people a reason to return the reply card.
Well, we'll send them this nifty pet waste water bottle if you
return the card. So then we mailed this thing out, and sure enough, everybody says, yeah, I want a water bottle. Well, we know people read the piece because they had to open it up and they had to read it in order to know that they were going to get a water bottle. So we did that with a whole bunch of our communications. We have here, we got a few handouts here. Can you help me with this? You know, we sent out right at the beginning of the school year, we sent out a bunch of pens, and then if you called up in the springtime, you got a spring toy, which is actually a pet waste slinky. And if you called up right around daylight savings time, right at daylight savings time, we sent out the pet waste flashlights, which were a big hit. Now, this also plays on a couple of different concerns. This is not only the incentive to return the reply card, but it also has our message stamped on it along with our pet waste website. We have a pet waste website, believe it or not, and it's stamped on here. So it actually starts to become what's called a buzz marketing campaign. Because I guarantee that anybody that gets a pet waste flashlight is not going to stick it in their pocket. They're going to go, look at the pet waste flashlight I got. Who ever heard of such a goofy thing? So it also plays loosely on a theme that we heard from people, which was that in the wintertime it's dark and I can't find them, because after I get home from work, I go out in the yard and I can't find them, so that I have to wait until spring or wait until the weekend before I can go pick up my dog's waste. So we develop all this stuff in the hopes that we're conveying this very, very simple message. So and it's important to remember that it's not an information campaign in the sense that we're using these things to spread the message. These things, although superficially that's what they look like, the reason that we really created them was because we needed a way to monitor whether or not people were actually reading our stuff. So that's really not the core of the program. But at its core, we really want to know if people are actually picking up. But we can't go around in people's backyards and scrounge around on our hands and knees counting dog waste. You know, we can't go sneaking around in people's backyards counting piles. That doesn't work. So how do we do this? How do we figure out whether or not people are actually doing it? So we use what I call proxy measures. And this is, in this case, we use a proxy measure that's a sticker. You put it on your garbage can. I don't think I brought any of those. It's a sticker that's about this tall, nice and weather resistant. You stick it on your garbage can, and it says, "We scoop." Now, this is playing on a concern that people told us in the focus groups, that they were worried about what the effect of the dog waste was on the garbage man. So they weren't worried about the dirty diapers, they weren't worried about all the rotten meat and everything else that people throw in garbage cans, but they were worried about the dog poop in the garbage can. So we thought, well, let's give them a sticker that they can put on the can to warn the garbage man. And so we mailed these out to all the houses, and lo and behold, all of the dog owners stuck them on there. And we thought, okay, well, as a proxy measure, is somebody really going to go to the effort to stick this on their can if they're not putting their waste in the can? And we're thinking, okay, no, probably not. So it's one measure. It's not perfect, but it's one indicator. Now, what we also did was we stuck one of our staff who drew the short straw. We put her on a garbage truck, and she was out at 4 o'clock in the morning with the garbage haulers driving around the neighborhood picking up all the trash with the garbage haulers. And she's looking for blue bags, for blue pet waste bags, as the bins were getting dumped. And it turns out in the end that didn't work because you couldn't see it good enough to tell. But what she did discover is that she could see every one of these stickers that was on a can, so we can start tallying up in our pilot neighborhood which houses were picking up and which ones weren't. So we got a real good indicator of what our adoption rate was as we started to diffuse this through the neighborhood. The other thing that we also discovered is that people don't always do what you think they're going to do. You know, we developed a sticker, and we thought people would stick it on the side of the can like that. Almost nobody did. Everybody put it on the lid. And the reason people put it on the lid was because they thought, well, if the garbage hauler is going to see it, he's going to pick up the lid in order to dump the garbage, and he's going to see it when he picks it up. He's not going to see it if it's on the side. So they thought it through very differently than we did. So you know, chalk that up to lessons learned. You know, we essentially build these programs so that way they've got a whole bunch of things in there that can fail, so we can learn what not only what does work, but what doesn't work. That's just as important to us. And it's also important, this is to remember, this is a behavior change. We're not worried about education. In none of this material, there's probably one out of probably about 50 pieces that we developed, information pieces that we developed, that actually says anything about water quality. We're really not interested in explaining to people all of the nasty stuff that's in their dog waste that is harming water quality, or why it's bad for salmon, or why it's bad for, you know, anything else downstream. What we're interested in is simply getting at the behavior. And we're not just making this up as we go. This has a strong body of social science behind it, and it's got a long marketing history in commercial marketing. If you really want to dive into how do you diffuse innovations through a population, I strongly advise you to look up Diffusion of Innovations, Everett Rogers. It's the seminal work on this area of study. We're also focusing, as I mentioned, on what is happening here. We're not as interested in the activity measures. The activity measures are how many people did we talk to and how much stuff did we hand out or how much stuff did we mail out. We're not as interested in that. It's handy when you're budgeting your program and developing your program so you know how much money you're going to have to spend and how you allocate your staff. But it doesn't tell you if you're getting results. What we're really interested in are the outcome measures. And that's how many people did what we asked as a result of our actions? How many people are actually picking up their pet waste in this program? Now, eventually we need to get farther down the road and we need to say, is the water quality actually improving as a result? But that's a much harder thing to do. That's a landscape level measure that we pick up in our long-term ambient monitoring program. There are so many sources of fecal contamination in streams beyond dogs that we can't measure it directly. So we can't actually go into this neighborhood and say, well, okay, if 50% of the people start picking up their pet waste, did we have a 50% drop in fecals in the stream? It doesn't quite work that way. There are too many variables in that equation. So what we do is we rely on our long-term ambient monitoring program to say, okay, we've got a program that's addressing pet waste, we've got a program that's addressing septic systems, we've got a program that's addressing car washing, we've got a program that's addressing all this other stuff. Now, over a 10-year period, is it actually working? Are we actually seeing better water quality? What this monitoring strategy also tells us is which of our communication pathways are working and which ways are not. I mentioned before that we expect to find failure in the pilot programs. That's why we do a pilot program. So through our monitoring, we develop a program where we've got all these different vectors for communication, and we find out through the monitoring which ones work and which ones don't. And in this case, 4 out of 5 didn't work. So when we take it from the pilot stage and we go countywide with this program, we don't go to those 4 out of 5. We don't waste the taxpayer dollars on talking to pet stores or schools or activity clubs about it. But ironically, activity clubs and pet stores were the first places where everybody said, hey, did you talk to these people about pet waste? Well, we did, and it didn't work. It didn't produce any kind of a measurable result. Talking to veterinarians did produce measurable results. So that's where we go. So we took a very similar approach programmatically with streamside landowners, but what we're asking of them is much different. We know from our research that we have about 16,000 streamside landowners. This is people who live, this is households that are right on streams where people are living on the streams in Snohomish County. And we know from our public opinion research that about 52% of the population says, yeah, I'm ready and willing to do more for streams and water quality. They don't know what, but philosophically they're ready and willing to do more. So what we're looking for is the intersect between those two populations. And we're going to look for the streamside landowners that are ready and willing to do more. And then this is the laundry list of stuff that we want them to do. This is the list that you saw earlier. We went to our staff and we said, what are the things that we really want streamside landowners to do? They gave us this big, long laundry list.
in order to make it palatable for people, we had to boil it down to a top 10 list. And once we boil it down to this top 10 list, then we've got something that we can mass market. It's easy for people to digest. It's easier for people to understand. And it's also put into plain English rather than using any technical jargon, so that way people can grasp it. We do our research, we do our formative research, and we start to learn what are the motivators for people to do this. Responsibility for future generations is the single most powerful motivator for people to do things that we've ever found. The concept of stewardship and leaving something for future generations is incredibly powerful. People will do things for their kids that they will not do for themselves. And we looked at this a little bit more and we said, well, that's probably true for people that have kids. But what about the people that don't have kids? So we did another survey and we started digging a little bit more, and we asked every question five different ways so we can start triangulating in on answers. We don't rely on any one question. We try to ask every question five different ways. And sure enough, people that don't have kids said, yeah, I want to leave something for future generations. I don't have any kids. You know, I'm not planning on it. Maybe I will someday, but I'm not planning on it. But yeah, I want to leave things for future generations. I want everybody else's kids to be safe. Very powerful. So we conducted a bunch of workshops. We advertised workshops. We took them into the neighborhoods. We didn't tell people, you have to come to the other end of the county or you have to go downtown to take this workshop. We brought it to people's neighborhoods and we held it in the local elementary school. That's why people are sitting in such tiny chairs there. You know, people came in and they sat for 3 hours in these tiny little chairs and they listened to people talking about streams. And then they went outside and they looked at a salmon stream. And they watched fish and they caught bugs in the salmon stream. And the whole goal of this is to bring the information to people, provide some training, and to give it a friendly face and try to break down all the barriers that prevent people from doing things. And the logic behind this is very similar to what we did with pet waste. We do our formative research at the beginning, we do our homework, we find out what makes this issue tick for people, we develop messages that work, we trial the program, we run a pilot, we don't go countywide with anything right out of the gate, because every time we do, we end up wasting money. Instead, we try it on a smaller population. Once we see what worked and what doesn't work on that smaller population, we tweak all of our information and our materials, and then we go countywide. So we tried all this on a population of 600 households before we went out to 16,000 households. And I guarantee you that talking to 16,000 households is not cheap. So we're protecting our resources very jealously. We guard what our taxpayer dollars are doing. Now, what this approach did was we sent out our mailer, or our advertisement for these things, and what this approach produces is filled workshops. We actually, for the first 2 years that we offered these workshops, we actually had to turn people away from the workshops because we got such a landslide response. And the reason is because every single word in this advertising went through focus groups. It was based on the research that we did. It reflects an understanding of the audience that we're talking to. Every single word. I mean, we went to the point where we spent entire mornings talking about two or three words on this thing. So the messaging on this thing is very important. You can't do off-the-cuff messaging, because it doesn't work. It's like shooting dice. There was very little guesswork involved in this. And this is the result that it produced. When we did the audience evaluation, at the end of the workshops, we sent out an evaluation questionnaire about 8 weeks after the workshops, because we weren't worried about whether people liked the coffee or whether people liked the muffins. We were more worried about what was sticking in people's minds. What did they remember after the workshops? And this is what they came back with. And these aren't cherry-picked responses. This is actually a cross-section of what people said. And this is a really bizarre thing. How many times have you heard people say that the government has a touch of empathy? I mean, this is a weird thing. But this is the kind of thing that tells us that we're striking a chord with the audience. And when we go to our legislative bodies to ask for funding to continue these programs, this is the kind of stuff that just makes them bubble over with funding. So that way we can start to grow these programs a little bit more.
So we also got a little bit of extra funding courtesy of the Puget Sound Action Team to
do some focus groups with previous attendees of these workshops. And what we found was that every single workshop participant that we were able to get a hold of told us what best management practices that they did as a result of the workshops. So we also did a lot of other follow-up research. Again, I mentioned before, I don't trust any one indicator. This was one of about five different indicators that we used to see if people are actually adopting the best management practices. And every single indication that we have is telling us that we're getting about 80% of the attendees are doing something. A little bit, if you trust the more anecdotal stuff, we're actually getting almost 100% implementation. So, for example, we did our initial mailing to about 16,000 landowners. That single mailing produced about 300 landowners that went to the workshops. Where's my pointer here? Is that it? Mm-hmm. So we got about 300 people that came to that particular set of workshops. About 50 of them left the workshop and asked our staff, can you come and visit my property to walk my stream with me because I have questions? And then out of those, we got about 40 of them that resulted in projects, on-the-ground projects. From those 300, in our follow-up evaluation of those 300, about over 240 of them told us that they did some kind of best management practices on their property as a direct result of the workshops. I had one guy, for example, that said, I went out, and the weekend after I went to your workshop, I went and I ripped up my lawn and I replaced it with trees. Now, not everybody went to quite that extreme. Not everybody's that bold. But that's an indicator of the kinds of things that people are doing. The way we marketed these workshops was to say, if you're going to dig near your stream, if you want to remove all your vegetation and brush, if you're going to do all this list of things that we really don't want you to do, then this is the workshop for you. And then when they got into the room, we said, instead of saying, no, you shouldn't do this, this is bad, we said, you can do it. It's legal. It's legal to cut trees next to your stream. There's no law preventing you from cutting trees next to your stream. But we walk hundreds of streams every year. Our staff are out every single day of the week walking streams. Here's what we see on the properties where people have removed vegetation along their streams. We see unraveling banks, we see this, that, and the other thing, you know, and we say, if you do this, here's what will happen. And it's stunning how many of the responses come back and say, well, I was planning a project and I decided not to do the project after hearing what you said. That's by and large what the response that we get. Now, these workshops cost us about $1,500 a piece to put on. So by our thinking, if it costs in the ballpark of around $1,500 to $3,000 to remediate a stream bank with damage on an individual parcel, we figure if we get one person to change the way they did things on their property as a result of a workshop, we're breaking even. And we're not getting, in the end, one person. We're getting at least 80% of them. So what we're doing is we're taking people from the information stage where they know things that they shouldn't be doing things, and we're trying to ramp them up through education, through facilitated action, where we're actually providing some kind of facilitation or help or technical assistance up to the point where they can actually do things on their own. And once they're doing things on their own, that's the point at which there's a public benefit. That's the point at which there's a resource benefit, because we're paying for all this education down at the bottom because we have staff that are going out, we have technical people that are going out and doing site visits. But it's only when people start doing things on their own that we're actually starting to see the benefit. It's only when we've actually changed behavior. And that's what this whole thing is all about. We're trying to change behavior on behalf of aquatic habitat and water quality. Questions? Yes.
What is the waste management practice for people that have horses? I know they're not in the city, obviously, but a lot of people have one or two horses. So.
In Snohomish County, there are a lot of horses. That's actually, we treat that as a completely separate set of BMPs.
because it's a different owner, they have different motivations, different issues. So it's not the same as dog owners. With horse owners, it's basically a composting practice. We try to get people to compost undercover, get it contained. What we're trying to do is stop the enormous piles of stall pickings that are pushed off to the edge of the property, usually which is along a ditch or a creek, and bring it in closer to the property, get it under cover, and actually start composting it in a more controlled way. It's not dissimilar to the way a lot of dairies are managing their waste, or the way a lot of commercial composting businesses are composting their waste. Yes?
Can you safely compost dog waste?
Can you safely compost dog waste? We haven't found a way to do it yet. A lot of jurisdictions, Snohomish County included, have recommended composting dog waste, and or burying it, or similar practices. Even the pet waste digesters and things like that. There are these little doggy septic systems. We haven't found any of it that works, and the reason is because it's very, very difficult to get compost piles hot enough to kill all of the pathogens that are in the dog. In the dog waste. That's very difficult to do. Now, when we started doing our focus groups and our surveys and things like that, we actually started talking to people in detail about what they're doing in their backyards. People said that they were composting, but more often than not, the people that said that they were composting were basically throwing their yard waste and their pet waste on the other side of the fence and just putting it in a pile. They weren't really doing an intensive composting method where they're deliberately trying to keep it aerated and let it heat up. And, even the commercial composters, like we talked to Cedar Grove Compost, they're struggling with this in a big way because they're always challenged with fecal contamination in their compost. So this is a real tricky issue for them, and their business can get shut down if it gets out of hand for them. So they don't want, they're trying to figure out how to deal with this too. Now, my dream is that someday the commercial composters are going to figure out how to get their temperatures hot enough where it does actually kill all the pathogens with a high degree of confidence, so that way we can just tell people, throw your pet waste in your yard waste. Of course, then we'll have an issue with the haulers, because the haulers hate dog waste and mixed in with the yard waste, but that's a different issue. Yes? Good question. That was one of the first questions that came up. It's actually a twofold question. One is, aren't we sending a lot of stuff to the landfill? I mean, do we really want to do that? Shouldn't we find a more natural way of dealing with this problem? And number two is, what about plastic in the landfill? So, to address this question, we went to the Garbage Project. The Garbage Project is a project that was started at, I believe it was the University of Arizona, under Bill Rathje, started in the 70s, and it's been going on for about 25 years now. And this is an anthropologist who took his students out, and under the auspices of trying to understand how populations live by examining their waste, which is a very common practice in anthropological circles, they said, let's go out to the city landfill and we'll try to figure out how people are living. So these people eventually, over 25 years, became experts in landfills. 50% of landfill waste is paper. When we talked to the haulers, we said, well, what about the volume of pet waste that we're talking about? And they said, how much are you producing? And we said, we're Snohomish County, countywide, is producing 20 tons of solid waste a day. And they said, 20 tons? That's it? We won't even notice that. It's such a small number, we won't even notice that. We talked to people that run the landfills, and they said, 20 tons? It's not even a blip on the screen compared to the paper and the construction waste that is going into landfills. So in terms of volume, this is a negligible thing to the people that are living with this every single day. As far as the plastic is concerned, the plastic is actually a very, very small volume of the waste in a landfill. The there's a broad misconception, and this comes right out of the Garbage Project research. There's a broad misconception that landfills are these big, vast composters. In the words of Bill Rathje, landfills are actually more like big mummifiers. Because basically what they do, when they take all your debris out to the landfill, they run over these huge, huge pieces of equipment that are very heavy, and they're designed to compact. And your trash is compacted to about the density of concrete. And it doesn't decay. It's packed down. Which is why when they start excavating in these landfills, they're finding hot dogs that are 40 years old. Now I know you're laughing, you're thinking, oh yeah, that's a hot dog. But they're also finding carrots and lettuce and celery and other stuff that's 40 years old in the landfills. They're finding newspapers that haven't shown any signs of decay whatsoever. So if we're finding 40-year-old paper in there, why would we think that anything else would be good? So the bottom line is we're basically storing it for later. Now, is that the best thing to be doing with our pet waste? Well, that's a tough argument. That's why I would like to eventually figure out how to do some sort of reliable composting process. But for now, until we can figure out a safer way of dealing with it, right now that seems like the best method. Next question. Yes?
Any improvement in water quality so far? When do you expect to see it?
It's a little too early to tell because right now we've done the pet waste portion of the program in a small pilot area, and right now we're ramping this up into a countywide process. So right now we're at the point where we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we take this from the pilot stage up to talking to 185,000 households? And that's a much different problem. So we're taking a good poke at that. Even just dealing with budgets, trying to find funding to do that kind of thing is a tough thing. So the jury's still out. We'll let you know. On the habitat side, from the screenside landowner work, we find almost immediate benefits in terms of water quality. When people revegetate their shorelines, we find very, very quick benefits. As soon as we get some vegetation growing along the streams, we get a riparian corridor that's 2 or 3 years old, we get almost immediate water quality benefits. And we've seen fecal coliform levels in agricultural areas that have been planted plummet very, very quickly.